and then hold.
All right, great. So here's how we're doing the class. Robert and I were talking about it, and we thought, you know, having taught, and in fact, team taught in a number of situations, it's pretty hard on the students to have the teacher switching back and forth. So what we're going to do is Robert is going to teach through the book of Hebrews, and then I'm going to do all the extra stuff. I'm doing the introductory material. We'll do a section on predestination. We'll do a section on falling away. We'll do a section on the priesthood. We'll do things on types and foreshadows and prefigures. So I'm going to do all the little side trips. Whether I'll be coming in at the beginning, at the end, or in the middle in any particular class, I don't know. Probably I'll be up here every week. I'm not even sure necessarily I'll even be up here every week. So probably 35-40% of the time will be me teaching, 60-65% of the time will be Robert teaching, but we just feel like it's probably better for one person to kind of actually go from verse to verse from beginning to end. Class is going to go either 6 or possibly 7 weeks. As it gets close to Christmas, it's a little bit tough to maintain that momentum, but that's the plan. So my job then is to introduce the book of Hebrews. Alright, how many of you have read the book of Hebrews? All right, so you know a little bit about the book. I'm going to talk first who the book is written to. It's kind of funny. I've read a couple commentaries. You can see Robert's pile. Where's your pile? Robert brought about a third of his pile of commentaries on Hebrews there. One of my favorites is this one here. It's the MacArthur New Testament Commentary. The reason is this commentary is written from the point of view of predestination, of Reformed doctrine. And so this guy thinks that once you're saved, you can't possibly lose your salvation. Now think about that. If you know much about the book of Hebrews, anybody who has a Reformed doctrine, I think, why in the world would they even want to write a commentary on Hebrews? It's very, very problematic. And so, by the way, the audience of the book of Hebrews, I believe, is just Christians generally, all right? And especially those who are from its Jewish descent. Some people say this book was written specifically and only to Jewish Christians. But as I read the book, I don't see that at all. I mean, first of all, I'm not Jewish, and it just, man, it's fantastic for me. I do think, though, I get the sense that the immediate audience to whom this is being delivered in the form of a sermon, most likely, by the way, probably was a group of Christians which had a lot of Jews in that church. But this guy said, as there's three different groups here. In fact, let me see. I'm going to read a little something here. Okay. He says, there's three audiences. The first audience is Hebrew Christians. Alright, so Jewish Christians. And the second audience is Hebrew non-Christians who were intellectually convinced. So I'm going to read a little paragraph here. It says, we must understand that three basic groups of people are in view throughout this epistle. If one does not keep these groups in mind, the book becomes very confusing. In other words, he's saying one group he's speaking to is saved people. Another group he's speaking to is Jewish people who have been coming to church for years and years and years, but haven't been baptized yet. All right, and then there's a third group of hearers, which is basically Hebrews that weren't even convinced of Jesus at all. He says, if we read the book, we'll become really confused unless we realize that one of the audiences is people who are believers who have been coming to church for years but haven't been converted. All right, now think about that. Think about what you know about the book of Hebrews, because he's got to explain away a bunch of stuff here. So here we go. If one does not keep these groups in mind, the book becomes very confusing. If, for example, as some have said, it was written exclusively to the Christians, extreme problems arise in interpreting the number of passages which could hardly apply to believers. All right, now do you see the logical reasoning here? The reason we know that the book is written to non-believers is because we know once saved, always saved. Now, that's kind of bad logic there. Because in other words, he's allowing his theology to determine who the book was written to rather than just reading the book and letting the book's contents itself say it was written to. Anyway, reading on. And because it so frequently addresses believers, it could not have been written primarily for unbelieving either. So it must have been written to include both. In fact, three groups in this Jewish community are addressed. Here's the critical basis for understanding the epistle, and here's where people often get mixed up, especially actually interpreting chapter 6 and 10. Because he's going to interpret chapter 6 and 10 as being written not to Christians falling away or leaving God. It's to people who like almost became a Christian and then falling away, as if you could fall away from something that you never had. Now, another thing is second generation Christians. And I know that for a couple of reasons. First of all, just the passage. Hebrews 10:32, he says, remember the former times. Have you all ever kind of had a little talk like that? Remember the former times? Remember the old days or whatever? So now, obviously, I'm assuming there's young Christians in this group that he's speaking to. I assume there are, but it's one of those sermons where the preacher is preaching to everybody, but he's mainly preaching to the ones who've been around for a long time. In fact, I'm going to get ahead of myself. The date of writing is probably somewhere between 65 and 70 A.D., and these are Christians who've been around for about 20 years. So in other words, the audience of this book is people who have been Christians for about 20 years, have done great, but they're kind of losing it a little bit. I'm looking around the room. I'm seeing people who have been Christians for about 20 years, and they've done some really great things, but you know, maybe they've lost a sense of identity. And that's one of the major points of the book, I believe, because, again, the church in the 60s and 70s, especially right around 70 AD, there was a huge switch in how the church thought about itself. Because a lot of people, a lot of Christians felt like they were a part of Judaism, essentially. In fact, the outside world viewed them that way. They looked at the church and said they're just a sect of Judaism. All right, but there's this little tiny event that happened in 70 AD. You know what I'm talking about? A little thing in 70 AD. And in fact, we'll talk about that. But because of the destruction of Jerusalem, it became like not so romantic a thing to be associated with Judaism. So the church is going through an identity crisis. They're not sure exactly what they are and who they are. And again, I'm saying, have we here, as this group of Christians that everybody here in this room is part of, have we gone through an identity crisis in the last few years? So that we're not sure exactly where we're going. And has that caused some of us even to fall back? Now, maybe not the group in this room, maybe the group in this room, but certainly the people that we fellowship with. It's almost like, you know, you go to church and they preach a sermon. Remember when you were a young Christian, they preach a sermon, you thought, oh, what did he do, a survey, and he asked questions and he designed it for me? You know, you remember that when you were a young Christian? The book of Hebrews is a little bit like that. It's like it's written to a group of Christians, other than the fact that we're clearly not very Jewish at all. Other than that, it's written to a group of Christians so much like us, it's like, wow, it's kind of interesting. So Hebrews 10:32, remember the earlier days. And now, one thing, we don't really know the exact audience. But it's in the form of a sermon. I'm going to talk about that later. I'm jumping the gun on a lot of stuff I'm supposed to say down to the next slide. But who exactly, I don't know. But in Hebrews 13:24, it says, those who are from Italy greet you. All right, so there you go. That tells me something. Now, there's two possibilities. Either the writer of Hebrews is over here, and he's got a few people from Italy, all right, and he's addressing this to those in Italy. See what I'm saying? So this letter's written to people in Italy, and he's saying, oh, the folks I met that know you guys said hello. That's one possibility. That's more likely possibility, in my opinion. It doesn't really matter. Maybe. But the other possibility is that that he's just been in Italy, just finished taking a tour there, and the people in Italy are saying, hey, to you guys over here. So it's possible that the immediate audience of this sermon was the Christians in Rome, the Christians in the house churches in Rome, and we know that there was a fair amount of Jewish, there were a number of Jewish people in Rome. Now, actually, they'd just been kicked out of Rome a little bit before that. We'll talk about that a little bit. So the date of writing. Now, let me go down to my next slide to kind of back it up here. In the context of Hebrews, he talks about persecution. And he's reminding them, oh, you went through some really, really tough persecution. Now, what persecution was that? Well, the first Roman persecution of the Christians was that under Nero, where? Where was that first Roman persecution of Nero? Where did it happen? What city? In Rome. Now, again, speculation here, but it's possibly he's writing to the Christians in Rome. And so he's referring to the persecution of Nero that happened in Rome, which was right around 64 A.D. Nero, as you can see, ruled from 54 to 68. But the persecutions, you know, the whole thing with the city of Rome burning down and Nero's looking for an excuse. You know, some people are accusing him of burning it down on purpose so he could rebuild it according to his style or whatever. So and Tacitus even says that Nero tried to blame the Christians for the burning down of Rome. All right, and so it was a local persecution. I imagine most of you associate Nero with persecution of the church. I assume you do. The persecution of Nero was on a scale compared to Diocletian and Decius. It was like just a little pimple or something like that compared to what happened before, because it was only in Rome. But then again, if you're one of the ones who got crucified, and you know, it's probably pretty major for you, I would think, and your family, and it may have been hundreds of Christians torched there, but on a scale is relatively minor. So anyway, so this is a group that have undergone significant persecution. So probably the book is in the mid to late 60s. Now, a key verse there is in Hebrews 8:13. Let's read Hebrews 8:13 to kind of give a context for the date of this book. Now, do you have to know the date when this book was written to understand what's being said? No. All right, but it's helpful just to get a feeling for the audience, the context, because we're gonna see some things, we're gonna get little hints, and what he emphasizes, the way he says it, and how, and even how we're gonna apply that to us definitely relates. So Hebrews 8:13. Let's see here. Okay. By saying a new covenant, he has declared the first is old, and what is old and aging is about to disappear. He's talking about the old covenant. In fact, when you read Hebrews 9 and 10, he's talking about these sacrifices, and he's implying the sacrifices are still being made. And we know the temple was destroyed in AD 70. Titus came in there, Vespasian first, Vespasian left, Titus finished the job, AD 70, tore down the walls of Jerusalem, burned the city to the ground, burned the temple to the ground, offered sacrifice, the abomination of desolation, right there. And that ended that. So, it's entirely possible that when this book was written, Vespasian was already in Palestine. The rebellion started in 66 AD. The persecution in 64, 65. This book is probably after that. The rebellion against Rome started in 66. So it's very likely when he says what's old and aging is about to disappear, this is not some incredible prophecy. He's saying, folks, you can see what it's happening. You can just watch it happening. They've rebelled. All the power of Rome is going to Jerusalem. Folks, it's coming to an end. And you think about that. He's talking about the Jewish things. He's talking about the things that are going to disappear. And he's talking about how much greater what we have in Christ. Because these people are about to lose something. I mean, not all of them are Jewish Christians, but a lot of them are Jewish Christians. And if you think the Jewish Christians didn't think Judaism and sacrifice was important, you misunderstand Jewish Christians. Think about the book of Galatians. So this is a group of people who are about to lose something that they think is of amazing value. And we're going to see in the book of Hebrews, he's talking about Jesus is so much better. Jesus is better this way and that way. I mean, Jesus is so much better. You guys are losing practically nothing. It's just a shadow. All right, give you a little bit of context of the audience here. Is that Titus or Vespasian? That's Titus. Vespasian was the one who brought the army in, 66, 68, surrounded Jerusalem. He had to take off. It was Titus who was the general who actually destroyed Jerusalem. Probably within a year or two, at most 3 or 4 years, from when this book was written. That's sort of cool to think about, just to give you a picture of the Roman Empire. All right, so probably somewhat likely, but certainly not proof, somewhat likely, the book of Hebrews was delivered as a sermon to the Christians in Rome. All right, and it'd take a little while for the armies to get all the way over to Jerusalem, obviously, where the war was about to take place.
Okay, good. Next slide.
By calling this covenant new, he's made the first one obsolete. And by the way, this is the Arch of Titus. It wasn't actually put up until, I believe, 79 AD, but it's a commemoration of the war where Titus defeated Rome and destroyed the city of Jerusalem in AD 70. I think I actually took that picture. And there's the arch. This sculpture is right on that side of the arch. And what you can see, these are Jewish slaves. Did you know that the Jews built the Colosseum? Did you know that? Jewish slaves who were taken captive in AD 60 built the Colosseum. And that's the context of the writing of the book of Hebrews. The context of the book is the people who valued these things so much, and it's about to all come to an end. And he's saying, you know, basically saying, you know, remain faithful despite all that. So this, and you can see, there's the menorah. I mean, it's pretty clear. When you go through that arch, if you didn't know the context, you see that, what the heck is a Jewish menorah doing on this prideful arch of this guy Titus? And who's Titus? Titus is the general who finished up the events that were prophesied. I probably shouldn't even call it prophesied here. If I'm right, it's not even a prophecy so much as, like, I'm thinking that Obama's going to win the election next Tuesday. I wouldn't call that a prophecy, all right? I thought that a pretty reasonable prediction based on what we know. You see what I'm saying? Get the idea? It doesn't take a prophet to say that. Who's the author? This is the classic question. The answer is, we have no idea who wrote this book. We have no idea who wrote this book. I'm not sure if it matters. In fact, you know what? I was reading a commentary. I think this is a really good point. It's almost good that we don't know who wrote this book. If there's any book in the New Testament, it's almost good we don't know who wrote it, is the book of Hebrews. Because what's the book of Hebrews about? It's about Jesus. And you know what? I think it's probably just as well as an anonymous author. All right? If you think about that. But nevertheless, commentators, they can't help it. And we are introducing the book. For 1,000 years, I mean, the sort of going opinion, certainly in the Western church, was that Paul wrote the book. But it's one of the least likely answers for who wrote the book. I suppose it's less likely that Pontius Pilate wrote it, but of people who maybe wrote it, Paul's not a very good choice. And having talked with Robert just last week, he agrees, because he can actually read Greek. By the way, I can't read Greek. And Robert is not maybe the top Greek scholar in the world, which proves how strong a case this is. He says, when you read Hebrews and you read Paul, it's like, there's no way this is by Paul. The Greek in the book of Hebrews is so eloquent. And Paul's first language was probably Aramaic, although I believe he almost certainly grew up speaking Greek. I mean, Greek, it was sort of like a Mexican-American, something like that, where they're quite natural in both languages. But probably Greek wasn't his first language. It was probably his second language. So what we're talking about is a very, very good guess is Hebrews was written by a Jewish Christian who was very highly educated.
In Greek,
in fact, Greek was probably his first. A Greek Jewish Christian. You got that? A Greek, like Stephen. Stephen didn't write this book. Yeah, they took care of Stephen, right? And they knocked him off. But somebody like Stephen, whose first language was Greek, who was very, very eloquent, that would certainly be Stephen. Jewish, though. I mean, the 30 quotes from the book of Hebrews, 30 quotes, direct quotes from the Old Testament, and then at least 70 allusions to the Old Testament. It's like the book of Hebrews is absolutely saturated in the Old Testament. Which, of course, is one reason people have said this is written to Jewish Christians specifically. Some people say even Jewish believers who haven't been converted. That's ridiculous. All right, so Barnabas is a good guess. If I had to give an opinion, Apollos would be my best guess because he was so well known. Because one thing for sure is this book was received as inspired by God. Okay, so it would have to be, even if it's not an apostle. I mean, Luke wasn't an apostle. That book was received as inspired. It would have to be somebody who was very, very, had a very, very strong reputation in the church. Barnabas, I'm not sure Barnabas was Greek so much. Apollos certainly was Greek. I mean, the name Apollos, I mean, check it out. The name Apollos,
What Jew would name the kid?
Origen, who was from Alexandria, writing around 220 AD. the quote from Origen was, God only knows. And so, you know what? I'm going to go on to the next question. We're not going to worry about who wrote it. We'll just say a Greek Jewish Christian who was very, very steeped in the Old Testament. Okay, now let's talk about the book itself. As you read Hebrews, it's not like a letter of Paul. Now, Paul doesn't have to just write letters. The fact that the mode of writing wasn't like that of Paul's, that's not a super strong argument against Paul being the author. It's more the language and the style of writing and the kinds of words. But bottom line is, it's not a letter. All right, we have a lot of letters in the New Testament. We have these general, the Gospels. Okay, and that when we have Revelation, and Revelation is a collection of visions. The Gospels are histories, essentially. Acts is a history. And then we have a bunch of letters. So what is Hebrews? Scholars say it's very likely it's simply a sermon. It's a sermon. It's the transcript of a sermon. And that was something that was done more in the past than today. In fact, I've read the collection of the works of Spurgeon, and you can read every sermon virtually that Spurgeon ever gave, because he wrote it as a transcript, essentially, before he even delivered the sermon. So it's pretty likely it's a transcript of a sermon. And as you read the book, it's basically it goes theology, application, theology, application, theology, application, theology, application, theology, application. And it's, I guess we don't know exactly how they organized their sermons back then. All right. But it just has the feel of somebody delivering a sermon. And it's sort of like you're sitting in the audience, and the subject of our sermon today is how to stay faithful. Not just stay faithful, how to grow as a Christian. Alright, and I'm guessing everybody in this room today is here because you want to grow as a Christian. You want to grow in your faith.
Amen.
All right. So it oscillates between theology and exhortation. 30 direct quotes from the Old Testament, at least, probably more. At least 70 other indirect references to the Old Testament. I mean, saturated in that. But bottom line is, you're reading a sermon. So as Robert goes through the book, I have a feeling he's going to do a fair amount of just simply reading, because the book of Hebrews was meant to be listened to. All right, and to some extent that's true of Paul's letters, because he even said, read this letter before the church. All right, good. Now, a little bit about the history of the text. We don't know when the book of Hebrews was written by any hard evidence, but that's true of every book. I mean, you can't say, we don't have the autograph, we don't have the original one. Even if we did, what, you know, is it going to say, you know, the year 37 A.D., all right, carbon 14 dating is only good to plus or minus about 40, 50 years. What we do know is, like I said, almost certainly written before A.D. 70, because it's written as if the destruction of Jerusalem hasn't happened yet. It was quoted as early as 96 A.D. by Clement of Rome, the letter of Clement of Rome, writing to the church in Corinth in AD 96. He quotes from the book of Hebrews. That's worth mentioning. The book of Hebrews was somewhat controversial as far as getting into the New Testament. By 95 AD, the four Gospels were circulated as inspired documents accepted by everybody. By 95 AD, if not all, virtually all of Paul's letters were circulating as a group of letters together as inspired materials. But there were other books where people weren't sure. And one of the ones that people debated, even well into the second century, was, should the book of Hebrews be in the New Testament? And basically, people decided a book that should be in the New Testament based on apostolic authority. So the key question was, did this book have apostolic authority? Did the apostles give the stamp of approval? Anyway, Origen and Clement, these are people, not Clement of Rome, this is Clement of Alexandria, these are people at the end of the second century, and they're saying basically the consensus of the churches is this is inspired, but even now, to say 200 AD, there's some people who are not sure necessarily it should be in the New Testament, because that was when the time people were still deciding. Any questions about that? I mean, it was generally accepted as inspired, but it's one of the books that was accepted a little bit more slowly. All right, into the New Testament. There's just a picture from Ephesus to give you a feeling for the... this is not Rome, it's Ephesus, but this kind of city that probably where these Christians were. We think of back then as people unsophisticated, hillbillies, not very educated. This was a highly educated culture. And one thing for sure is, you know, he's assuming knowledge of the Old Testament, that it's like very, very striking knowledge of the Old Testament, because he's just going through all this stuff about the law and the sacrifices, as if he's assuming, obviously, the audience knows exactly what he's talking about. These people were educated people. These people were people, the audience, of course, there were probably young Christians in there who were like, huh, what's he talking about? Hmm. But the majority of his audience, they knew the Old Testament backward and forward. All right, good. Let me see. The purpose of the book. The purpose of the book is to give heart to Christians who've endured but have been tempted to waver in their faith. I already said that, basically. Like I said, the audience of the book, it's us. People who've done great things. In fact, they're famous for having done great things. They've done amazing things. And it's not like they're about to fall away right now. But they haven't been growing. They're stagnant. They're not sure... They're not sure where they're going. They're wondering. Like I said, they're having an identity crisis. So one thing for sure is it is a strong, almost harsh warning against falling away. Now, maybe you're tempted to think that that's what the book is about, because the book is by far more about assurance. I mean, you know, we need to recognize that, yes, you could lose your faith and you could go to hell. That's not the main subject, the thrust of the book, but it's certainly there. I mean, Hebrews 10, Hebrews 6, I mean, that is devastating stuff. That is tough stuff. So basically then, the purpose is to give heart to the Christians to get back on a track of growing, of having a strong faith. The theme of the book is the preeminence of Jesus. Jesus is awesome. When I taught through the book of Hebrews about a year and a half ago, I actually went to a thesaurus because, you know, awesome, great, amazing, fantastic, spectacular. Because basically on every page, Jesus is amazing and he's spectacular. He's incredible. He's so much greater than this. He's greater than Moses. He's better than the angels. His priesthood is better than that. Blah blah blah. I mean, Jesus is amazing. 10 times over amazing in so many ways. The greatness, his deity, the greatness of his ministry, the greatness of his sacrifice, and compared to Judaism. I mean, and Judaism is great. And remember, the audience thinks that Judaism is really pretty amazing. Saying compared to the Old Covenant, it's like there is no comparison. I'm not going to go through the outline. I'm putting the outline up there just to give you a feeling for the flavor of the book. All right. So it's basically Hebrews 1:1 through 2:18. Jesus is great, therefore. And then again, Jesus is great. Therefore, and then Jesus is amazing, is spectacular. Therefore, you got that? So it's like a call to action, but it's a call to personal action. It's a call to personal action in your own life to do the things and to be the things that are going to make you be far more faithful and to get back growing again. So you don't just sort of either fall away or just barely make it. Because I don't know, to me, if I just barely make it, that'd be pretty awesome. I mean, I'll be in heaven. I'll go, oh, man. All right. But I don't know about you, but that's not good enough for me. That's not good enough for me. I don't know, you know, because I want a little bit of heaven right now. All right. So anyway, Jesus is better than the angels. So pay attention. Jesus is greater than Moses. Persevere. Jesus, the priesthood of Jesus is greater than the priesthood of Aaron. So let's move on to maturity. Jesus, the great high priest, he's the author of better covenant, he's blah blah blah, therefore let us persevere today. And he goes on and on in that one. And then, again, a practical example of endurance. These guys endured much greater things than you. All right, therefore, accept God's discipline in your life. That's kind of the quick outline. All right? But I'm not going to steal the thunder from Robert, so I'm going to let him do that. And you may even do another outline yourself, I'm not sure. So, a couple more things before I give up the floor here. Things to look for in Hebrews. And I'm assuming you're going to be reading the book in the next few weeks? Rereading it? Yes?
Yes.
Alright, let's consider that an official assignment here. Alright, first of all, this one you can't miss. If you miss this one, then I'm worried about you. But the things to look for is things that make Jesus awesome. Alright, those are not hard to find. But just pay attention. Just pay attention to lists. Pay attention to the things Jesus is being compared to. And maybe even think about, why is he talking about the angels first? And then, why does he talk about Moses second? And then, why does he talk about Melchizedek? And then Abraham? Think about the outline. Think about the outline of the book and try to imagine, assume this is an inspired book, therefore it's even an inspired outline. And assume that everything about the book is like totally God's hand everywhere around it. So be thinking about that. Another thing to look for is let us. So exhortations. This book is jam-packed with exhortations. And as soon as you see let us, just so you know, you're about to have an exhortation. Let us be careful. Let us make every effort. I'll let you find those. I've got a list of them right here. This is at my website, by the way. I've changed it a little bit. But if you go to my website, just put in Hebrews or something like that, and you'll find this, including notes, by the way. And those notes might be useful because the notes that I have for the book of Hebrews are not the notes for this class. They're pretty much Robert's notes, so that might be a nice supplement. All right, other things to look for in Hebrews: types, prefigures, and foreshadows. And by the way, if you're not an expert at finding those, well, I wrote the book, all right, From Shadow to Reality. I'm kind of an expert at finding those. So that's a significant amount of the sort of side trips that we're going to take are going to be me kind of helping you to find those. But just to give you a feeling for it, Hebrews 9, 6 through 10, just kind of so you see where we're headed here. Hebrews 9, 6 through 10. These things have been set up this way. And he's talking about the items in the temple. The items in the tabernacle. Hebrews 9, 6 through 10. These things have been set up this way. The priests enter the first room repeatedly performing their ministry. Blah, blah, blah. It's down to verse 9. This is a symbol for the present time. The Jews thought this was important. And I guess it was, but he's saying the whole thing is just a symbol. All this stuff they went through. The main purpose of it was to create a symbol. Now, which is more important, the symbol or the thing being symbolized by the symbol? You get that? So when you read the Old Testament, you're reading about Jesus. And the book of Hebrews is just reminding you of that in stark terms. Let me continue on. It's a symbol for the present time during which gifts and sacrifice are offered. They cannot perfect the worshipper's conscience. They are physical regulations and only deal with food, drink, and various washings imposed until the time of restoration. And let me skip down to Hebrews 9:23-26. Therefore, it was necessary for the copies of the things in the heavens to be purified with the sacrifices, but the heavenly things themselves to be purified with, what's that key word in the book of Hebrews? I might be reading a different version. Mine says, better. Got it? Better? Better? Butter. Better, butter. What is that? Better, butter? Is that a parquet or something like that? A parquet? Better, butter? I don't know. That just popped in my head. I don't know. Good. Another thing to look for is warnings about losing your salvation. Again, now, of course, our friend John MacArthur said there are no warnings in Hebrews about you losing your salvation. How could you read Hebrews 3 and come to that conclusion? That is ludicrous. Again, if I was John MacArthur, I would have picked another book to write a commentary on. I'm serious. I've got listed on the screen there several of the passages. You're probably familiar. I think for those of you who've read Hebrews, which is all of you, I think probably that's one content of Hebrews you're pretty well aware of before taking this class, I assume. Alright, another thing is the eschatology. Oh, there's a big word, eschatology. You know, basically is the thinking about end times of the writer of the book of Hebrews. Okay, the writer of Hebrews is feeling like Jesus is going to come back pretty darn soon. Alright, in Hebrews 1, verse 2, he says, in these last days. And what are the last days? Well, Peter said in Acts chapter 2, he said, these are the last days. So, and the writer of Hebrews is saying, in these last days. So, he didn't have to say that. He didn't have to say in these last days. He's saying in these last days because he wants the Christians to realize that Jesus could come back in any moment. So just bear that in mind, folks. Now, you know, I want you to endure to the end, but bear in mind, the end might be tomorrow for you and everybody else here. Of course, we all know that intellectually, we're aware you could die by tomorrow, but, you know, those who are below 60 live as if that was totally not true. And, you know, I think when you get older, you start feeling like you could die tomorrow. So, be prepared. The writer of Hebrews wants you to recognize that basically your time could end. Now, I've got more things I could say about introductory to the book, but I'm going to stop right there because I want Robert to get well into chapter 1, and in fact, he may have time to get into chapter 2. So let's take about a 2 or 3 minute break while we get him mic'd up. You can get another muffin if you want, and then we'll start in about 3 minutes.
Thanks.
So, I'm going to just keep the tape running and we'll just have space in there. Here we go.
Is there a guy?
Yes.
On the outside or
straight through?
No, through there.
To the right to that.
Forever, the world's going to know that Tim was going to the bathroom because it's on the tape. Okay. I think we can do that.
Can you pause?
Yes, but I have to take it off of hold.
8 years.
Is there a pause? Stop.